Welcome to Bloomberg Opinion on Bloomberg Radio, bringing you news, comments, and insights from Bloomberg Opinion's worldwide team of editors and columnists. I'm your host, June Grosso. This week, how big tech squeezes its smaller rivals. Also on the show, the holiday shipping snafu that wasn't. Plus, a look at the British royal family spinoff of Harry and Meghan. But first, Democratic presidential candidate and billionaire businessman Tom Steyer is in favor of term limits for Congress, a proposal he claims will help end corporate control of Congress. Here's a clip from one of Steyer's recent campaign ads.
I'm about to say two words that will make Washington insiders very uncomfortable. Term limits. You and I both know we need term limits, that Congress shouldn't be a lifetime appointment. But members of Congress and the corporations who've bought our democracy hate term limits. Too bad.
Not everyone thinks term limits are a good idea. Bloomberg Opinion columnist Jonathan Bernstein writes that it's one of the worst ideas in presidential politics this cycle, and he's here to tell us why. So, Jonathan, why is it such a bad idea?
Well, first of all, it's a solution in search of a problem. The truth is that there's been heavy turnover in Congress lately. Two-thirds of the Senate and 70% of the House have served 10 years or less right now. So it's not as if these are all people who have been around, you know, for 30 years or something like that. It's not a lifetime job as it is. So, you know, the first part is this is not something that needs to be corrected because it's not even a problem. But the truth is that Congress represents people. Members of Congress try very hard to represent their constituents. And first of all, it takes some time to learn how to do it, but it also takes the electoral incentive that you can make a career out of it.
So in other words, you think that if you're a congressperson as a career, then you have more incentive to work harder and please your constituents.
Exactly. You know, if you know you're only in there for a couple of years, you know, there's sort of this fairy tale that everybody would just do what's good for the country if only they didn't have let politics get involved. But it's actually sort of the opposite way. If politicians are out there without a career, without any reason to keep their constituents happy, then they'll do whatever they want. And that might be something really good for the country, and it might be something which will help them get another job. It might be some whim of theirs that has nothing to do with what anybody wants. There's no particular reason that it'll be aligned with what the voters want. The reason that politicians do what voters want is because they're up for re-election.
And it certainly seems as if term limits isn't something that the public is clamoring for.
I think that's right, and in part because this idea that we have an ossified permanent legislature, that just isn't true. The other thing about term limits is that the alternative to incentives to do things for the voters turns out to be doing things for organized, small, powerful interest groups. And, you know, I'm all for interest groups getting involved in politics, but we've seen this. You know, the political scientists have actually, it's one of the things that's easiest to test because states have passed term limits for their state legislatures. So political scientists have been able to go in afterwards and say, ah, what happened? And what happens inevitably when you weaken a legislature, you strengthen interest groups.
Now, another policy consideration that he has on his list is instituting regular national policy referendums. First of all, how would that work exactly?
He doesn't seem to know, at least from what he said. He sort of has this vague idea that it would, you know, that you would just do this and everything would work. The truth is, it's another way to take influence away from voters and give it to special interests. You know, I don't like to bash interest groups. I don't like to bash. People deserve representation through their system, whether they're individuals or groups. But term limits, referendum, they tend to favor those groups that are organized, that have a lot of money, that have a lot of influence. In other ways, it sort of reinforces that instead of the way elections work now, which is balances off against the power of those kind of groups.
So let's take Steyer's policy priority of climate change. So how would this national policy referendum work in regard to climate change?
Who knows? What we do know is in states where they have these things, interest groups wind up writing the referendum. You know, the thing about a referendum is legislation, laws are complicated. Something like climate change is a very complicated issue with lots and lots of details. Well, there's two ways you can do it. You can write an oversimplified, referendum, and then somebody in the government afterwards will have the job of figuring out what it really means. Or you can write a really, really detailed thing, and then nobody's going to read it because, ordinary voters are not going to read hundreds of pages of legislative language.
Now, I'm getting a hint, just a hint, from your column that you don't think much of Tom Steyer's policy position.
Climate, whatever, that's not my department. But how politics works, how the American government works, that is my department. And political scientists have put a lot of study into this. And, the thing about the referendum, you don't really have to get all into the details of it. All you really have to do is just, remind everybody of Brexit.
Yes.
If anybody thinks that was a good way to run things, well, they're welcome to Steyer's nonsense.
How do you think he's doing as far as the debates are concerned?
I think he sort of sticks out. He was the one candidate in the most recent debate, the Iowa debate, who doesn't really have a serious chance to win, and he looked like it. He looked like he didn't really have depth knowledge of the material. I don't think that he's sort of a serious candidate. The truth is that politics is serious business. You're talking about things that change people's lives, and politicians who are qualified for the job, who have worked in politics before, have held elective office, have held important government positions, are the ones who are really qualified to be good at the presidency.
Thanks, Jonathan. That's Jonathan Bernstein, a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. Last week, home speaker company Sonos filed a lawsuit against search giant Google for infringing on its wireless home speaker patents. According to the complaint, this alleged infringement allowed Google to reap $3.4 billion in Google Home revenue in 2018 alone. However, even if Sonos wins the lawsuit, the smaller company will lose. That's according to Bloomberg Opinion columnist Joe Nocera, and he's here to tell us why. So, Joe, your column says that patent aficionados may be familiar with a term called efficient infringement. Tell us what that means.
Well, it's one of the ways that the big boys in tech push around the little boys in tech. Basically, it means that the big companies know that they're basically stealing someone's technology. They're infringing on their patents. But they also know that because of various changes in the law and Supreme Court rulings, they can get away with it because there's really literally nothing a company can do to stop it. They can be forced to pay money, but if you're Apple or Amazon or Facebook or Google, money is like sand. It's everywhere. So it's meaningless.
So tell us how the Supreme Court opinion basically stopped judges from issuing injunctions.
Right. That's one of the core issues, is that the Supreme Court, about 10 years ago or so, it made a ruling that basically said that made it much, much harder to grant injunctions. They had in the old days, or before that, it was very easy to grant. A company would say, they're infringing on my patent, and we need a preliminary injunction to stop them from doing it. And then that means you'd have to withdraw the product from the market, or you'd have to do some kind of workaround. It was a big mess. And that often caused companies to either get a license or come up with some solution. And then the Supreme Court changed the rules. And they made it, they said, we got to have a four-part test to decide whether there's going to be an injunction or not. And the net result is judges stopped ordering injunctions. And the minute they did that, the smaller companies lost all their leverage. They didn't have a leg to stand on. They could sue, they could win, they could get money, but they couldn't stop a big tech company from violating their patents.
And for even in the future, they couldn't stop future infringement either?
Correct. So, and often these cases take so long that by the time the 5, 6, 7 years is up, the piece of technology is outmoded and you're on to infringing the next piece of technology.
Now, is this deliberate infringement in most cases?
I believe it is. If you're one of the companies, they say, well, no, we're not infringing. It's our own technology. We never looked at their product, which in the case of Sonos and Google is absurd because they actually had an alliance and they were working together on the technology. But in my view, it is definitely willful and it's definitely known. And they basically just say, come get us.
Now, what about the America Invents Act? Did that help at all?
That actually made things worse. The America Invents Act was designed to really put the clamps on what are called patent trolls, which are these companies that really don't invent anything or don't do anything. They just buy up vague patents and sue everybody in sight and try and get enough settlements to generate money. So the American Invents Act was designed to stop that or at least slow it down. But what it also did unintentionally was create a situation at the patent office where they set up a new review process that allowed companies to challenge patents that had already been granted by the patent office. And so if Sonos has 100 or 200 or 300 patents, Google, one of the tactics they could use is to go to the patent office and say, you know, we're challenging 100 patents. And then Sonos has to spend the next 2 years defending their patents and spending millions of dollars instead of being able to carry on their litigation. So that's another way that the big boys grind down the little boys.
Now, has Sonos tried to negotiate with Google?
Well, Sonos has been in negotiations with Google. I mean, this is another one of the things that, you know, this is very much in dispute. Google says we were making great progress in the negotiations. Sonos says we weren't making any progress at all. So that's why we finally felt we had no choice but to negotiate. There are other examples, many, where the company won't negotiate at all. Apple famously doesn't negotiate in many of these cases and won't even answer the telephone. And basically what you have to do is the suing is the only way you can get their attention. So and Apple would say, well, you know, if you call us, you know, you're handing us your we don't want to infringe on your product. Therefore, don't even call us.
Uh-huh. Now, there is a Senate subcommittee that's considering this.
Yes. I mean, this is becoming a hot issue among the small and medium sized technology companies that invent things and have proprietary technology. I mean, this is happening a lot. And so on Friday, there was a hearing of a House Judiciary Subcommittee in Boulder, Colorado, where, you know, four different companies, including Sonos, are testifying about their problems. And I do think that the Democrats in particular are interested in trying to change the America Invents Act, at least enough to give these medium-sized companies at least a leg to stand on.
Is that something that Republicans would go along with in the Senate?
It's hard to know. I mean, as a general rule, Republicans tend to favor the big companies, but that may be an overstatement.
So in a case like Sonos, where that's a product that people really know and like, are they able to survive this?
Well, Sonos is in an unusual position because they have a really well-known brand. A lot of these technologies are very obscure companies, and the technology itself is something that only a technology insider or an engineer would understand. But Sonos has a really good brand. And, you know, at Christmas time, you know, yes, you can buy a Google system or you can buy an Amazon system, especially the Echo system. But If you want the high end, if you want the best speakers, if you want the best sound, you go to Sonos.
Isn't this a problem really with the legal system and tech companies? In many, many areas where the tech companies are so big and have so much money, and it's a drop in the bucket when they're fined or when they have damages. And so the little companies are sort of out of luck.
Well, I mean, that's exactly the point. I mean, take again the case of Apple. Never mind its revenues and its profits. It has $200 billion. In cash. So if it has to pay $250 million, as it did a few years ago, to the University of Wisconsin because it infringed their patent, I mean, that's penny. It's pocket change. As they say, it's chump change.
Whenever I hear about the cash number of Apple, it hits me every time.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. That's Joe Nocera, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. This past holiday season had all the makings of a logistical nightmare. Thanksgiving fell late, which shortened the number of days carriers would have to ship an unprecedented number of packages. Back in 2013, a shortened shopping season spelled disaster, but investments in better technology helped this time around. Here to tell us more is Brooke Sutherland, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. So remind us what happened in 2013 with some Christmas presents.
So in 2013, it was a short period between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and this also coincided with a significant spike in terms of e-commerce shipments, and UPS just couldn't handle it. And so, you know, a lot of packages that had been promised to arrive in time for Christmas did not, in fact, actually make it in time. And retailers were not happy. They had to issue refunds. They had to hand out gift cards. And it created, you know, a huge issue for UPS and FedEx, who then have spent, you know, the intervening years spending billions of dollars to revamp their networks.
So now this was also a short time between Black Friday and Christmas this year. How did they do this year?
They did really well, actually. So this was the shortest period between Thanksgiving and Christmas since that 2013 holiday season, and it seems to have generally gone fine. You know, I think there was a lot of concern heading into this, just given some of the doubts among investors whether all of the spending by UPS and FedEx had actually paid off. And then you also did have, this would be the first time that Amazon was operating with a full-blown logistics arm. And for the most part, it seems to have gone well, and I'm basing that off of the fact that there was not the social media outrage, customer angst that you saw back in 2013.
Explain the logistics end of Amazon.
So this started because they were spending so much money to ship all of their packages, and they were frustrated with how that was being handled and frustrated with some of the performance shortfalls, and they decided that, you know, this would be better done in-house. And that has expanded significantly. Right before the holiday season really got underway, they said they were on track to deliver 3.5 billion packages globally in 2019. And that, you know, about half of Amazon-specific packages are carried by its own logistics arm. I mean, those are really staggering numbers. And so this has really sprung up very significantly in a short period of time.
So did putting all this money toward making sure that the packages get there on time, did that have an effect on profits on the bottom line?
So we don't know yet. We don't have earnings numbers from FedEx or UPS. We will get those in the coming weeks. But, you know, I will say, despite all this spending, we did see a little bit of a slippage in their on-time delivery rates, according to estimates from SJ Consulting. But why that arguably didn't translate into that type of customer angst, the social media outrage, is that, you know, if you think about it, you don't care that much if a package is supposed to arrive on December 14th and instead it shows up on the 16th. The one day that really matters is the 24th to get that in time for Christmas Eve. So you'll note, you know, when you go on retailers' website, there is a countdown to how yes. late you can order in order to get it in time for Christmas Eve. And so I think they've gotten a lot more strict about that, and that has helped to make for a smoother holiday season in the end.
And how is this affecting the post office?
So FedEx actually took some of the volumes that it had been shipping out to the post office and now bringing those in-house. And part of the argument is that the more density that you have, the more profitably you can handle e-commerce shipments. You have to remember that for a long time, most of these carriers were primarily delivering packages to businesses. That's a lot more profitable for them because you're delivering a large amount of packages to one place versus dropping off one e-commerce shipment to various different homes. So, you know, as they try to figure out how to make this business profitable for them, they're really focusing on density. So for the post office, that has meant losing some volume.
You also wrote in your column about Boeing and its corporate hubris and mismanagement of the 737 MAX. So tell us about that.
I mean, I think it's really staggering. There's been a number of developments with Boeing in the past couple of weeks, and one of which is the release of a new batch of troubling emails between employees about the development of the 737 MAX, where they are at times derogatory toward regulators, toward foreign airline customers, toward their own colleagues. And I think for me, one of the biggest issues is that when Boeing released these, they said that they were doing so proactively and in the interest of transparency. And I think it is very telling for Boeing that they would say something like this. And for me, it signals how far they have to go in order to make the cultural changes that they need to. You know, we are more than a year into the MAX crisis. They have already had to publicly release a batch of emails to the FAA and to Congress that they, you know, were accused of withholding from those bodies, despite giving them to the Department of Justice. And so the fact that you're still sort of getting this drip of information, it is just is illogical. And it also raises a lot of questions about whether Boeing really fully has a grasp on the situation.
Thank you, Brooke. That's Brooke Sutherland, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Last week, British royals Harry and Meghan, also known as the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, made a shocking announcement. The couple announced plans to step back from their current roles as senior members of the royal family and split their time between the UK and North America. While the move blindsided the Queen and royal aides, Harry and Meghan's decision actually makes sense if you think of the British monarchy as a business. That's according to Sarah Green Carmichael, an editor for Bloomberg Opinion, and she's here to tell us why. So, Sarah, as I mentioned, this came as a shock to the Queen and others, but you write that it's consistent with the long-term strategic plan attributed to Prince Charles. How so?
Yes, Prince Charles has been attributed to come up with this plan to modernize the monarchy, and that means slimming it down a little bit. So you don't have every aunt, uncle, and cousin and hanger-on living off the public largesse. You have a narrow monarchy that really focuses on the monarch, the heir, and his or her direct heirs.
Has the Queen decided already how much the Duke and Duchess of Sussex are going to get from not only the Queen's largesse, but also from Prince Charles?
No, that all those details, as far as we know, are way still up in the air. And I think, you know, it's important to note that even if the long-term plan was a slimmed-down monarchy, we're a long way from that now. You know, the Queen is still alive. She's still the one in charge. You know, if Prince Charles wants to do this, he'll have his turn one day, but that time's not now. So all of those details were still to be worked out. So I think what was surprising was that Harry and Meghan decided to make this announcement on Instagram instead of speaking with one voice and coming out with a fully laid out plan endorsed by the Queen.
As you write, they've managed over the past couple of years to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Tell us.
Yes, they have had a few run-ins with the press, to say the least. The biggest of these, and one of the most recent, has been an ill-considered lawsuit that they launched against several media organizations, accusing them of multiple things, violation of copyright, you know, for example, and other issues. But they really have felt mistreated by the press, and that has led to a very adversarial relationship between the press and the royals. And some of the other issues that have come up for them are things like, you know, this summer they were sort of chiding people about having too big a carbon footprint, and then they were seen taking a private plane. So there have been some of these other dust-ups as well that you just see sort of time and again getting blown up in the press.
How do the British feel about Harry and Meghan and them getting money, even if they stop and step down from their role?
That's a great question, because it's really not as easy to disentangle the finances here as it would at first seem. So Harry and Meghan themselves are worth millions of dollars, and they have a net worth that is estimated to be around $30 million. But that may not be enough to support a transatlantic lifestyle with the level of security that they would need as two very high-profile people who are close to the Queen. The costs of security are very hard to estimate, and the costs of security are traditionally the part of their lifestyle that is most funded by the public. So that has been a real sticking point. And of course, you know, even if they want to stop taking the Queen's money, they still live on a lot of their father's money. So to say that they're not taking money from the Queen is one thing, but then to not take it from their father, who's the Queen's heir, you know, people are not quite sure, I think, if that's a distinction that really gives them the kind of independence they're saying that they have now.
Is the monarchy still as popular as it once was with the British people?
The monarchy is still quite popular. I think where you see some differences is that younger people tend to be slightly more in favor of abolishing it. So if on average about 1 in 5 British citizens would like to abolish it, if you look at younger people, it's more like 1 in 4. So I think that is something for the royal family to keep in mind is, you know, there is always the chance that, like other modern countries, their citizens will decide to do away with a formal monarchy at all.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That's Sarah Green Carmichael, an editor for Bloomberg Opinion. Americans got some fantastic health news last week. Based on the latest data from the American Cancer Society, U.S. cancer deaths are plunging at the fastest rate ever. However, this data stands in sharp contrast with many other persistent and worrisome health trends. Here to tell us more is Max Neeson, a Bloomberg Opinion healthcare columnist. So, Max, why the sharp drop? Which, you know, great news, why the sharp drop?
Sure. So this is a few different things. The biggest one is the continued drop in the adult smoking rate and just sort of the compounded effect of the fact that, you know, for something like 30 years, fewer and fewer Americans have started smoking or kept smoking. That means much, you know, fewer people getting lung cancer, fewer people getting really bad lung cancer. And then you get some contribution also from new medicines. The fact that we've developed a greater set of medicines that are, you know, targeted to really specific genetic defects, to specific cancers that are helping people live longer or sometimes helping people beat cancer entirely. And we're likely to see a bigger impact from that even in the years to come. I'm thinking, for example, of Keytruda, Opdivo, medicines like that, these sort of immuno-oncology medicines that have had some really dramatic effects in some patients. Those were only really starting to be approved in these really big patient populations and in lung cancer, which continues to be the most prevalent type of cancer over the last couple of years. So more to come from that benefit. But still, it is sort of telling that the biggest reason are not these expensive new medicines.
Right.
It's smoking cessation, which is much cheaper to kind of promote.
Why are drug companies focusing so much on cancer treatments?
You know, there are a lot of different reasons. In general, since, you know, fewer people get cancer and fewer people get specific types of cancer, these are more narrowly targeted drugs. And also because cancer progresses quite rapidly, you get sort of what are called events, you know, people progressing or passing away pretty rapidly. And those combine to make for clinical trials that are shorter and less costly to run. So they're cheaper to develop and they are more expensive to buy. So because they're generally targeting small populations and a given health plan only will have a few people that need a specific drug in a given year or over even in a few different years, they don't really push back as hard on the price of cancer drugs. When you talk about insulin or you know, heart disease drugs, on the other hand, they might have hundreds of people taking them. So they're very, very price conscious there. So you have this combination of shorter development cycles, the fact also that we've learned a lot about cancer, and high prices that are driving drug makers towards these types of medicines.
Are there areas that drug makers are ignoring, like insulin, because they're focusing on cancer treatments?
Absolutely. You know, there are sort of these sort of explicit examples we have. One would be, you know, Sanofi, a giant French drug maker, outright just a bit ago said that it was giving up on developing diabetes and heart disease medicines and focusing on, among other things, cancer. And then you have sort of these quieter, you know, examples in the data where you have this sort of relative dearth in development of medicines that treat depression, for example, and that treat addiction. You know, and also antibiotics research has fallen by the wayside in large part. You know, some of these are scientific difficulties, but the relative focus also comes because they are less profitable, these medicines, because they address broader patient populations.
You write that there are plenty of intervention initiatives that deserve greater funding, including efforts to reduce obesity and lower infection rates of hepatitis C and HPV. Aren't those areas where the public, especially efforts to reduce obesity, where the public would flock to any kind of treatment?
One would hope. These are difficult problems. I highlighted these specifically because these are also other potential sources of preventative cancers, specifically HPV and HCV infection and obesity as well. Though we have interventions for those latter two, mm-hmm. obesity is tougher. I mean, if we could have a medicine there, it would be huge. Difficult development problem. Lots of people have tried, lots of people have failed. But also, many fewer people are working on that than are working on, mm-hmm. Medicines for cancers that have a prevalence, one in thousands or millions of people. So there is a lack of funding, a lack of incentive for these efforts relative to what drug makers know that the American healthcare system will pay for, or what it will reward. So that's something that probably needs to change a bit.
What about Alzheimer's, which we're hearing more and more about and is a very frightening thing for most Americans who are, past the age of millennials, let's say.
Mortality there is still getting worse and likely to get even worse as the population ages, but where there's been a real lack of drug development success. Part of this is the fact that, drug makers have been chasing a hypothesis about how to treat the disease that has failed repeatedly. It's partially the fact that we don't entirely know where to go, but also that, they've chosen to focus resources on cancer instead for some of those reasons I mentioned earlier. An Alzheimer's drug requires a long period of difficult research, a lot of failure, and massive expensive trials that in the past have not paid off.
Thank you so much, Max. That's Max Neeson, a Bloomberg Opinion healthcare columnist. And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Opinion. You can read more at Bloomberg.com/opinion or at OPI and Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. For Bloomberg Radio, I'm June Grosso. Our producer is Samara Lenga. Thanks for listening, and remember to tune into the next edition of Bloomberg Opinion right here on Bloomberg Radio.